Well, we have started from the back. I figure a good way to know what's in a book, what's in a constitution, read the table of contents, and look at the index. So if you have questions, you know, does the church have a stance on something? You can look at an index. You can look at the table of contents. You can also call Mr. Manili, Josh Manili, who works at the RP Seminary, is an archivist, correct? And he might be able to help you find out if the Synod of the Church has said anything about these topics. So minutes of Synod go way back to when? 1880s? Okay, maybe even before that a bit. But rulings of Synod, what did they say back then in their cultural context? So we've looked at the index, looked at the table of contents, we have discussed the Covenant of 1871, and we've gotten now into the suggested forms. So if you have a constitution, we're on H1. And this is where we were last week. We have a certificate of transfer of membership. And one of the things you'll discover quickly about the Reformed Presbyterian Church and other Reformed and Presbyterian bodies is we take church membership seriously. There are many churches that do not. And if you show up and you attend for a couple of months, you end up on the mailing list and they consider you a member. We have membership requirements that are a little different. So we actually have a certificate of transfer of membership. So if somebody were to leave here and go to another church, we would send a transfer of membership. And we are in the process of receiving one of those, actually two of those, from a church in Colorado for Tori and April Mann, who have transferred their membership here, met with the session a week ago, and now we just wait upon this form to transfer membership. And one of the things that we are conscious about is who's responsible for this person in terms of their spiritual life. So if they're living here but a member back there, formally it's their church at home that's responsible to oversee them, make sure they're doing okay, but practically it's obviously where they're living. So we like to see people transfer memberships and be where they are. And so that's given a date and time, and the clerk of session, the moderator of session, sign off on this. There is a certificate of dismissal. So if somebody simply is dismissed from the church, and this could be taken then to another congregation, say I was dismissed from this other congregation, and here I am, and I can present that to the new church. There is a certificate of reception on H2. It's the form 1B. Certify that so-and-so was received into membership. And this could be returned to the dismissing session. I'm not sure how often this form is actually used, but that would be a question for our clerk, who is. Any of you know who the clerk of our session is? Drew Gordon. Right, he's the he keeps all the records and paperwork, and he signs things. So he would send this back to the dismissing congregation, say, we've received your member. A certificate of dismissal for an indifferent member. What is an indifferent member? Okay. One who's not participating. Indifferent means I don't care. So the session certifies that you, name of the member, have not participated in the worship and fellowship of the congregation for an extended period of time, and we are deeply saddened that we must remove you from the church because of your neglect of the ordinances as of this date. So indifferent simply means I stop coming, I'm not interested in being contacted, I drop out of my small group, I stop giving, all of those kind of things. So after trying to recover somebody like that, you can simply remove them, dismiss them. Certificate of dismissal for a member requesting to be removed. And it may be that along the way, somebody says, well, before they become indifferent, they say, I simply don't want to be part of this congregation anymore. For whatever reason. And we remove them from membership at your own request. So we give them a certificate that says that. And they can hang on to that, because if something changes in the future, they could take that letter to another congregation saying, I was a member up until this time, and here's my letter of dismissal. But usually when this happens, and in different members, they don't really care about the certificate. But we do, so we communicate that through these forms. So all of that to say, we take membership seriously. And if you are a member here, you have affirmed the covenant of church membership, and we'll be looking at that in the future. You've made promises. You've made affirmations. And we, as a congregation, believe you. Yes, ma'am. Well, you, nothing. They can remain on a roll of baptism, I'm guessing for an indefinite period of time, though at some point somebody might give them one of those forms, because baptized members are members. They're not communicant members, and they've never taken the covenant of church membership, but they are still church members. So I could see at some point, as a child grows up, becomes a teenager, goes into his 20s, and never affirms that faith, that the membership would simply be removed at some point. But we do have a baptismal role. And I haven't seen that role, so I don't know who's on it. You've been around a lot longer than I have here. Have you seen a role of baptized members and kind of what has happened if they don't? Okay. Did you guys have a practice in Seattle that you remember? Right. We're affirming in many ways what has already transpired. They have no interest. This person has no interest in the church. We're simply acknowledging that fact. Absolutely. So have you run into this before? Is this a question that you've seen in a congregation? Mm-hmm. Well, we would announce something like that, probably, that so-and-so was removed. Or we might not. I don't know. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, yeah, membership roles are significant because representation at the higher courts is based on whether you have more or less than 100 communicant members. So that can be an important number. And we also get billed by the synod based on membership for a particular, I think it's for the pension. I'm not exactly sure what, but there is a billing that happens. Maybe it's for the work of synod. I can't remember, but there actually is. So we have a similar kind of thing. So we do want to make sure that the role is correct. The proverb talks about keeping a good accounting of your flocks and herds, that kind of thing. So there is something to that. Like, who is this person on the roll? I have never met this person. I've been here for 10 years. Why is this person on the roll? And we have a few of those with whom we are in contact who have never been here while I've been here. And they've asked to remain here for a reason. And I can probably tell you that the session's not agreed entirely on how to approach that, but the majority is agreed. And that kind of is what matters. So, but we have some discussions about what to do and how long do you hold somebody. Yes. So, yeah, for families that are in flux, they're moving, work, all those kind of things. Think about soldiers who are deployed. They may be out of the country for 3 years, that kind of thing. How is this all handled? Home congregations, particularly if missionaries are sent. I mean, there is some stake in maintaining a person on your rolls. We keep that contact until they kind of get settled. We hope that missionaries will eventually become members of the congregation where they're working. So if you happen to go to South Sudan and you're a member here, our hope would be eventually you would transfer your membership to the Church of South Sudan. But you're right. I mean, our society moves quite a bit. So I'm a happy supporter of quick memberships, transfer. I mean, once you get someplace, transfer. I remember back in the day when I was at college, we used to have a thing called an associate membership, and we don't have that in our book anymore, and I don't know if that was a legal thing or not, but if a college student was going, like, to Geneva, was going to be in Beaver Falls for 4 years, going to actually spend more time there, could become an associate member of one of the local Reformed Presbyterian churches, keeping their formal membership at home, because they don't know where they're going to go after 4 years, and they're kind of back and forth a lot, so they're covered. But there'll be a way to maybe handle that. Jonathan, now that you've walked in, I just have a question. Are you taught at all on how a congregation, a session should handle a member who is baptized who never professes faith? Has that come up in class? Okay. Well, there you go. So, and I'm not going to ask you what you think you should do, but so that's about membership. Form 3, Certificate of Teaching Elder to Synod. As I mentioned last week, we have delegated courts. So members of the local session serve at the presbytery and at the synod level. And you are delegated to go, so you have the approval of the local session to go. And I am a teaching elder. We only have one here, but there are congregations that have multiple teaching elders. We call them pastors and associate pastors and that kind of thing. But this gives them the right to vote. Form 4 is the certificate of delegates to presbytery or synod. And that might include teaching elders. This thing, certificate of teaching elder to synod, is somebody, I should back up because this is covered here. This is covering somebody who is not currently serving in a pastorate. So, for instance, Ed Blackwood is a member of our congregation. If he wants to go to synod, he is a former teaching elder. We could certify him and send him on so he could go to synod as a voting delegate, as a teaching elder. We then, as a congregation, certify our ruling elders. And we would send two ruling elders and a teaching elder. And we have a presbytery meeting that this next Friday and Saturday up in Tusca. Thank you. And we will be there. And right now, I'm planning to go. We are delegating Jordan, right? And Timothy. So our younger elders will be going, Lord willing, this weekend. And they get to go. We have their approval. You can put down an alternate. maybe that one of these guys ends up can't go, so we have an alternate who's also certified. He could be there, he just doesn't get to vote. So we could send three or four, all of our guys could go, but only two of them, two of the ruling elders, actually get to vote. And that's important, so we know who's representing whom, and do you get a say? And so we welcome any elder to come to the presbytery meetings. In fact, presbytery meetings, for the most part, are open. Anybody can come. And then we give permission to anyone who is an ordained elder to speak on issues, but then only the delegates actually get a chance to vote when a vote is called for, should that happen. Well, we'll get to that when we get to the, eventually, no, we'll get there. That's a great question, though. What's the distinction between a ruling elder and a teaching elder? Jonathan, are you taught that distinction? So what's the distinction? I'm going to put you on the spot. He's never coming again to class. So it's one office, different functions, which is why we allow the elders to do whatever the elders can do. Now, the state will restrict ruling elders from performing weddings. My function as a teaching elder, I am a professional witness, as it were, for the state. So I can solemnize a marriage. Ruling elders may not, because the state makes a distinction. And then ruling elders typically are not given permission to actually oversee the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. They can be given that permission by the presbytery, but ordinarily a teaching elder would be present for the preaching of the word and then overseeing the sacrament. So we kind of make that distinction as well. Historically, our church actually viewed it as two different offices. Our book no longer supports that, though there are still residual things in the Constitution that clearly come from an idea that there are two offices, not one. And so anyway, that's somewhat the distinction. But we'll get into it because there's quite a distinction in how they're called, who they work for. I'm ordained and installed by the presbytery. Ruling elders are ordained and installed by the session, by the other members of the session. So there's even a distinction that way. But in the future, we'll get to that. Form 5, petition for the moderation of a call. And this may be that a church does not have a pastor. And maybe they've not had a pastor in a long while. And the session might petition the presbytery, give us permission to make out a call. Now, typically, that's granted. So in the event that I resign or retire, we no longer have a teaching elder here. So ordinarily, when that happens, the presbytery would receive my resignation, and then they would promptly give permission to us as a session to pursue another pastor. So we could then issue a call at some point. But if that, for whatever reason, is not given, there may be trouble in a congregation, there may be other things that presbytery wants to address before a session might call somebody or a congregation might call somebody, they would say, we're not going to give you that permission yet, but then a form is there, so a session could say, or a congregation to the presbytery, we want permission to call a new pastor. And then they could grant it, but that would be the petition. Form 6 is the notice of a congregational meeting to elect an ordained officer or officers. And so there is a form that we use to say we are called together to elect up to two or three elders, up to two or three deacons, that kind of thing. And there's a form for that. So everybody knows it's happening again. This has to be publicly done, has to be done two Sabbaths, two Lord's days before the election might happen. And this is so everybody knows. What you don't want is some small segment of a congregation saying, we want to elect some of our people onto the session. So there's kind of, and I don't know if that's what's behind this. I can only imagine why there's kind of this requirement for public declaration and that kind of thing. Did stuff happen in the past that was not public? But we have a form here that tells people that we're going to have this meeting. You're allowed to vote by absentee, so you can send in a vote ahead of time. We don't allow for proxy votes, so you can't recruit 5 votes that you represent at the meeting, but everybody gets to send in his or her own vote for that meeting. Well, when the session would rule that we're going to do this, that we're going to call for a congregational meeting to elect officers, that form would actually show up in our minutes, which would then get reviewed by the presbytery. So they would know that we held this meeting. And then we actually inform the presbytery that we are calling, part of this whole process, which we'll get to, the form is just telling you that there's more stuff in the back of the Constitution. So we will tell the presbytery, like we did, that we're going to have an election, and then we had the election, and Timothy and Jordan were both elected to the office of elder. We're going to proceed to the ordination and installation unless there's a valid objection from somebody in the presbytery or maybe even in the congregation. So we actually inform the presbytery, the other churches locally to us, that we're going to proceed in this way unless somebody comes along with an objection. In theory, yes. Yes. So if we hear a local congregation is going to elect somebody and we perhaps know something about that person, it would behoove us to inform the session about something that they might not know. So that's part of our oversight of one another as we share in that. So then Form 7, if you're following along, H6, is the form for the pastor's call. So in the future, when our congregation is going to call a new pastor, or perhaps another pastor, we might at some point decide to have an associate pastor, or another teaching elder, there is a form that you fill out. It has to do with how much we're going to pay the pastor, what's the housing allowance, so there's some financial things, business expenses, how will those be handled, book allowances, there's a lot of things about money, and then other benefits, what will those be, is he permitted, how many days of vacation, to be where, when, can he go to synod, can he go to a church camp, can he be away for other reasons, non-financial compensation, they have an example, food for locker. I don't really know what that means. Food for locker, etc. I do know that a pastor friend of mine was paid in beef out in Iowa. So that might be part of this that says, look, we can't give you cash, but maybe once a year we're going to give you a cow. Cash cow. Or quarterly, we'll give you half a beef. I don't know what food for locker means, but that's the example that's there. Any Westerners here? I should ask Stan Copeland. He would probably know exactly what this means. But so you might get some other kind of compensation. This is going to list: do you have a manse or a parsonage? Who lives in a parsonage, by the way? A parson. Who lives in a vicarage? A vicar. Who lives in a manse? A pastor, I guess. I don't really know where the word manse comes from. So, and what is that? A parsonage, a manse, or a vicarage? Yeah, it's a house that's owned by the church. There used to be one next door, and it's long gone. And the pastor, it's there for really for the convenience of the pastor and the convenience of the congregation. And then this was very common historically in Reformed Presbyterian and Presbyterian circles along the way. And then guys started realizing that one of the ways to build wealth was to own your own home. And so the tax code allows for a housing allowance if you don't provide a parsonage. So pastors can buy their own house and grow wealth as property values increase, and they can benefit from that as opposed to at the end of their years of service retiring and then trying to figure out what's my housing going to be when I'm no longer serving as a pastor. Interestingly, I know within the Roman Catholic circles, when priests retire, they actually have homes for priests. And they actually provide then housekeeping and cooks for them and that kind of thing, and they'll just go and live there together, almost like a monastery, not quite, but that kind of a context of these guys living together in their elder years, and they get that kind of care. As far as I know, we never did that, but... What's that? We have wives. So there's always a question, what happens at the end? I do know that there are places where you want a manse, like in Los Angeles, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, because no pastor is going to be able to walk in there and afford a house. So hopefully our churches in such places, and they do, have manses or parsonages, because there is no way Noah Bailey, for instance, could afford a house near the Cambridge church building. No way, no how. So when houses are starting at $600,000 and $650,000 for small houses that need a lot of work, we're not going to afford that. So thankfully, the Cambridge church has a parsonage, and they live there, and that's great. So that's a lot of here that's in the pastoral call, and at the bottom of the pastoral call, there are lots of places for signatures. So when a call is issued, the elders sign, the deacons sign, the communicant members sign, non-members, what we call adherents, people that attend the church quite regularly, but for whatever reason are not members, will sign it. There even is a place for witnesses. I don't really know what that means, other than there's somebody witnessing that these are all right signatures. Okay. So their signature is affirming that everything went on was legitimate, and because they don't have a vested interest. Okay. So there it is. That's the call, and this is useful. Jonathan would have recently. You've gotten one of these, but you don't have the physical one yet. Where is that one? Okay. And this is the interesting thing. Jonathan is in a process, which we'll get to with some of these forms. He can't yet actually be given a call by the Fresno congregation because he's not yet eligible to get it. So there's a physical copy, and when he is approved, Lord willing, at synod time, that call will physically be handed to him. And then a clock starts. It's like 2 weeks, right? We kind of accept that a guy has about 2 weeks to think about it. Now, Jonathan has already had lots of time to think about it. I don't think he'll need 2 weeks. You could leave them on pins and needles and say, I'm not ready to give a response yet. But it's like a proposal of marriage. And sometimes you know right away, yes, this is what I want, and this is good for Jonathan because he doesn't, as far as I know, you've not been called anywhere else, so you don't have any other offers. So this is a good thing. But there is a time, perhaps, when a woman who's being asked, will you marry me, says, let me think about it. And sometimes that can throw the suitor for a loop, because he thought he kind of knew where everything was, but that's not the case. So sometimes pastoral calls come, and that's especially important if a man is not looking for a pastoral call. Because sometimes guys are pastoring just faithfully along their way, and then all of a sudden they get a call from another congregation. I have a friend of mine who got such a call. In fact, they called him ahead of time on the phone and said, "We have a congregational meeting and your name has been put forth." He said, "Do not call me. I'm not coming." They called him anyway. So they have to go through this process. They leave the call at the congregation. People sign it over the 2 weeks. Then they mail it. Presbytery has to sign off on it. Goes to his other presbytery. They have to sign off on it. Gets sent to him. He gets it in the mail. And then he simply folds it back up, puts it back in an envelope, mails it back and says, "I told you I wasn't going to take it." But that's what happened. So he wasn't really thinking about this place. This place called him anyway. And he said, "No." I also know of another story where a pastor church was vacant. They called a guy. He said, "No, I'm not interested." They had another meeting. They called him again. He said, "I'm still not interested." Called him a third time. Said, "Okay, maybe this really is of the Lord." So he went. But this is a process, and there's paperwork to do that. Of course, email and all and phones and have made this a quicker process. So PDFs can be made of calls. Originally, there was a physical call. And we trusted the United States Postal Service to deliver that call to the person in a timely fashion, correct. Form 8, we have a chaplain's call. It may be that a pastor is going to serve in the U.S. military during active duty, and there's a form for that, and we have had pastors serve that way. I'm not sure, do we currently have any active duty? I don't think we do. Stan and Kelly have both recently, in the last couple years, retired. By the way, just for interest's sake, Stan Copeland, when he was serving, was actually the oldest member to serve in the U.S. Army. So it was quite interesting. He said that whenever he showed up at any kind of meeting, he was always deferred to as the oldest serving member in the U.S. Army as a chaplain. But that was his claim to fame. He said that was about his only claim to fame. Stan is a very humble man, but that's true. Patrick Neely, right? No, not Neely. Patrick, what's that? Stefan. Yes, I think he actually is serving it. I don't remember which branch, but you're right. And then we have some chaplains that serve in prisons. So this isn't just for active duty military. They're also for those. Form 9 is for a missionary's call. Looks very similar to a pastoral call, though this is issued by a presbytery or a board, so it could be that our Board of Global Missions could call someone to serve. A presbytery could call somebody to serve on a mission. So it does not have all of the room for other signatures because there aren't members of a congregation that are calling the missionary. He's being sent. So, and we have a good friend of ours, the B family, who came through here, who has been sent to Central Asia, and that's where he's serving currently, and he would have such a call. And then Form 10, there's an edict for the ordination installation, which we've already mentioned that before. So if we're going to ordain and install ruling elders or a deacon, we fill it out, we announce it to the congregation, we send this form to the presbytery to say this event's going to happen. Form 11 is the certificate of eligibility to preach, which, Jonathan, you have, which says the presbytery is confident in Jonathan's ability to preach, so we can trust him. Before that, when Jonathan was going to be preaching somewhere, his sermons had to be reviewed, either by his homiletics professor at the seminary or by his session or some elders. They would have to make sure that what he was preaching was accurate. So once made eligible to preach, we've said, it's like driving. So when you've got your learner's permit, you always have to have a licensed driver with you. So, and then you get your license to preach, or your license to drive, and you can solo for that very first time. I am taking the car out. It's like solo flying, same kind of thing. And it's like, whoa, okay, do we trust this driver? Presbytery has taken Jonathan through a number of exams and said, we trust him as a preacher. Yes, Faith. They're not. And this is, again, one of those vestiges of two office, one office. So, Drew, where's your dad? Joel slipped out. He's preaching. Because of our view of one office, we have allowed ruling elders to preach occasionally, just once in a while, under the oversight of their session. So one of our ruling elders can't necessarily go to another congregation to preach without oversight of that session. So they take responsibility for it. If a ruling elder is going to be preaching on a regular basis, he would go through that first level of exams at the presbytery level to allow him to actually have a license to preach. And Joel, when he went through our presbytery, when he was a student under care, when he was at RPTS, he went through that process. So he actually was given a certificate for preaching. So if a ruling elder wants to do it, I don't know, more occasionally, is kind of the language of the book. I don't know who determines what that is, more consistently, they would at least go through to get the certificate for licensure to preach. But yeah, that distinction is still in the book, but it's not supported by our doctrine anymore because we view one office. So that's one of those things. What's that? What about it? Right, he has the license to preach. Form 12 is the certificate, eligible to preach. Form 12 is certificate of licensure, which means he's eligible now to get a call. So we have a two-step process. We allow a guy to start preaching, and then he is then eligible eventually for being called to be a pastor. So, and that's where Jonathan is right now. You have how many more exams? Four more. So, and all told, there are how many? Okay, so along the way, Jonathan will be examined on 15 different, and we'll get to those exams. They're also in the book, but this certificate is simply telling you they're indicators of things. And then like the edict for the ordination installation of elders and deacons, they have one for the installation of a teaching elder, and that's done under the oversight of the presbytery. Form 14 is the transfer of a call from one presbytery to another. So if Jonathan had been a member of the Presbytery of the Alleghenies, which is where we are, if he had come up through this congregation and Fresno wanted to call him, Fresno would hold their own meeting, get their call together. They would send it to their own presbytery, who would sign off on it. Then their presbytery would send it to our presbytery. And we would have to sign off on it as a presbytery, and then we could give it to Jonathan as under our oversight. So it's a little bit like, again, if you're going to ask somebody to marry you and there's a parent involved, that you might want to talk to the parent. Because our presbytery has oversight of this person. You can't just go past our presbytery to ask a guy. This has happened a couple times when our session was serving as what we call the ad interim commission. You have a group of elders who serve for the presbytery when presbytery is not meeting. And we were informed that a call had been made on one of our guys and that the call had gone directly to him. And we said, that's not legal because we can turn the call back. Even if the other presbytery has approved the call as fitting and appropriate, if we get the call, we could turn it back and say, we don't think you're paying him enough. It could be a financial thing. Send it back to him and say, you got to fix this. Or we could say, we don't think this is a good fit for whatever reason, and we could send it back. So presbyteries have that authority. You don't simply need to pass on a call. Even our congregation made a call. Our own presbytery could say, let's just say, I've retired, get a new pastor. We call somebody. The presbytery might say, we don't think that's a good fit. There's some things maybe the local congregation doesn't know about this man, or whatever. There may be different values or whatever, and a presbytery could say, nope, we're not going to forward that call. For whatever reason, you could fix it. If it's just a money thing, you might be able to fix that. If it's a fit thing, that might be harder to do. The ethics of, you mean the ethics of shepherd rustling? Okay. Typically we call it sheep stealing, but some people might think it's called shepherd stealing. Well, the ethics of that. Well, we don't have a pastor. We need a pastor. There's a really good one that we think is a really good one living over there. So we could offer him a job. So that's like the ethics of calling, of offering a job to anybody else that already has a job. And I might argue that that's also the case for a family moving. I mean, it's not unique necessarily to this. But yeah, there are people who are always kind of troubled by that. I mean, when congregations don't have a pastor, there would be some who would say, well, if we call their pastor, then they won't have a pastor. So it could be that a pastor is looking to make a change. So, almost, but there's an offer. He doesn't have to take it. We're not a bishopric that says after 7 years or 5 years, we're moving you, which happens quite regularly in other contexts. In a hierarchical church, in the Roman Catholic Church, in the Methodist Church, all those kind of churches, bishops move men after a relatively short period of time. And part of that is so you don't build a power base and get embedded. But we've had pastors serve 45, 50-year pastorates. Whether they ever got a call or whether they always turned them down, said, I'm embedded in here, I don't feel a need to go. But there may be congregations that say, it's time for you to go. There's really no... Congregations go through seasons. It may be that I'm here for a particular season, and I've gotten you to the season, now I want to move on to help a congregation in a similar kind of season. Maybe I have gifts in a certain area, and once the congregation has done what I think I can do, I need to go move on to something else. Congregations may know that. But it is a hard question. You know, you had a question or a comment, Jonathan. Well, we should revisit that. But I had an interesting conversation with a ruling elder, because I've been called a number of times, and I often go, when churches are vacant, I said, I'm happy to come and fill your pulpit and help you think through the process of calling somebody. I'm not looking for a call, but I'm happy to kind of extend your pool and be in this process to help you guys. And one of the elders at a church in Colorado, as we were talking, I said, you have to remember that what you're asking, if you're asking an existing pastor, it's one thing to call a guy out of seminary. He's lean and hungry and, you know, he's kind of this. But after a guy's been someplace for maybe 15 or 20 years, I said, you're asking him to change everything. I have a mechanic that I trust. I have a jeweler that I have a relationship with. I have friends in my Rotary Club. My kids are embedded in community, all these things. And he said, I have never thought of that. He said, I've only ever thought of in terms of hiring, you know, getting a pastor, calling a pastor to serve a congregation. I really didn't think that he's like I am. That's what he said. Like I am. I'm embedded in my community. I hadn't ever thought that so is he, and so is his family. And I said, yep, you're asking him to change all of that. So, yes. Yeah, and that's how the Lord leads. So there may be an inquiry, those kind of things, and maybe you don't know. I have told the sessions where I have served, if you ever think it's time for me to go, I want to hear it first from you. Because again, there may be things to say, you've been effective, but you're less effective. And historically, I've been told that RP pastors used to submit their resignations every 7 years, just kind of as a tradition. And then they stopped doing that, because too many of them were being accepted. That's what I've heard. So just so you all know, I will tell them this, that I had that conversation with my session last year, because I'd been here for 7 years. And they said, don't you mention that to the congregation. I said, okay, I'm not gonna do it, but just so you know, if you have a problem with me, you can talk to an elder and say, look, you had the opportunity to take his resignation. Why didn't you take it? So, but we need to wrap it up, but one last comment from our elder statesman. So that's how the Lord leads. Well, thank you for your attention. We will continue this, Lord willing, next week. More forms, more stuff behind them. Jonathan, maybe we'll... thanks for being here and being a good sport. And I'd like to know what's being taught at RPTS on some of this stuff. All right, well, we got about 10 minutes, a little less than 10 minutes. So let's turn our attention to the worship of God.